Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Your Booked, the podcast for literary nosy Parkers. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your host and the author of The Sisterhood, a love letter to the women who shape me. It's a tender and irreverent celebration of the connections we forge with women, viewed through the lens of my own relationship with my five adorable and infuriating little sisters. It's available from bookshops nationwide, and if you'd like to support the podcast, buying the book is the best way for you to do that. If you're on the Kent coast, why not come and buy it from the Margate Bookshop, my lovely local? This week, our fabulous guest is Ayesha Malik, the author of the smash hit Sophia Khan Is Not Obliged, which has been described as the Muslim Bridget Jones, meaning we have a heroine who doesn't drink but smokes a lot. This book was selected for this year's City Read London series, and we'll be talking as well about Ayesha's brilliant brand new book, This Green and Pleasant Land. Bilal lives in a sleepy village on the south coast. Against his better judgment, he decides to honour his dying mother's wish and build a mosque there. The locals do not rush to supply funding or planning permission. Ayesha has written an extremely funny, challenging and reflective novel about prejudice and love. This is a writer at the peak of her powers, meditating on humans at their best and worst. I truly loved it. We talked to Ayesha about class, praying, love stories and hardy heroines. I'm going to describe this. So we're in Ayesha's bedroom. We're in South London. And is this your childhood bedroom?
Yeah.
So, and there are books on every flat surface where there could be books. And some of those flat surfaces are other books.
Basically, yes.
Are there any books here that you've had since you were a teenager that you grew up with?
Yeah. So, The Wizard of Oz was given to me as like one of my birthday presents growing up.
Oh, so which birthday?
I think it was probably my... like 10th or 11th or something like that. And these guys here as well.
Oh, those are beautiful.
Yeah.
And just, is it all right if I grab the Wizard of Oz?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, this is, looks like a really, really lovely edition. So illustrated by Linda Birch. How would you describe the size? It is illustrated and it's kind of...
It's not the usual size.
I guess
is it?
It's almost like picture book size,
maybe.
And you can only see the scarecrow on the front, and Dorothy and her gingham and Toto, and a lovely. It's a very sort of rural yellow brick road.
Yeah, and you can tell it's old.
I feel
can't
a bit
you?
Bad that they've not. Do you think that maybe like Linda Birch drew the scarecrow and it's like, oh, the Tin Man, that's going to be really hard.
You have a good point there, actually, yeah.
So had you seen the film? Are you a big fan of the film?
Or... Oh, my God, loved it every Christmas. Yeah, I used to have to fight with the family over watching Wizard of Oz or a Bollywood channel, so...
How often did you win?
Not very often, Daisy, not very often. I also have a copy of Alice in Wonderland, but I think my niece has stolen that from me. So I'm not sure where that's gone.
So you're passing it on. That's really lovely. So what was
it
like?
Not intentionally.
So did you have an idea of what this was before you... read it. So was it weird?
I knew the story beforehand.
One of the first books where you kind of were really familiar with the film and then encountered the book.
I just remember being obsessed with the book, and I would read it every night. And then once I finished
it, got your name in it.
Yeah, really old handwriting.
Very neat handwriting.
I don't know why it's gone to shit now.
my handwriting, that is.
What do you think it was about it that you loved it so much? Was this the idea of adventure, or was it the friendship?
I think it was, and it was the idea of this yellow brick road and the fairies and the munchkins. It was just, I don't know why I loved it so much, and I never understood why she wanted to go back home.
That's a really interesting idea.
I always thought, oh, why don't you just want to spend your life in Oz?
Why don't any of us just spend our lives
in Oz?
In Oz. I see as well you've got the Andrew Carter's fairy tales. Yeah. So in that kind
which, by the way, vein. I've not read.
Ah.
So a lot of the books you're going to pick up, I'm going to say, actually, I've not read that yet.
Excellent. You know, I have this edition. It's really beautiful and it's pristine.
Yeah.
Possibly because it's not read.
It, yeah.
So how did it come into your life?
I think it was when I was doing my master's in creative writing, and my supervisor suggested Angela Carter, and a friend of mine who was also doing the course was a huge fan of her, so I bought it, and as you can see, I've never actually read it, which is a shame, but I'm glad it's on my shelf because I will get to it one day.
So when did you start writing? What made you decide to do a master's in creative writing?
I think I started at a fairly young age, I think around in my teens, even younger, actually much younger. There's a typewriter that I've stuffed under my broken drawers, which I used to type on when I was like 12 and write my stories.
What did you study before you studied creative writing?
English literature.
So were you always planning on doing creative writing?
Yeah. Well, not doing creative, but I always wanted to be a writer. So I just bit the bullet and did it.
Was there any one particular book that made you think when you were growing up reading, like, I could do this, or this is what I want to do?
Not I could do this, but I mean, I'm a huge Austen fan. Where are my Austens? Hidden behind there somewhere.
See, I think that's quite cool, because so lots of people would be like, here, they're my classics, my Jane Austens, but you've obviously got them close to your heart.
Because I'm always buying books and I'm just stuffing them wherever I find room. And then things get lost. But yeah, I loved Jane Austen so much. Oh, there's her Persuasion just over there.
I'm just being filthy. What's Jane Austen's Persuasion? Like Sarah Jessica Parker's lovely.
A lot of my writing, which was really awful in my early 20s.
I'm sure that's not true.
Honestly, it was really bad. I was inspired very much by her, but I did that thing that authors do, right? You just mimic what you love. And I was mimicking someone who wrote in the 18th century. 19th century, so that didn't really work very well for contemporary purposes.
But I think you have to try a lot of different voices before you find your own.
Exactly, yeah. And she was one of my first, so to speak.
So, and was there a particular book? Was it Persuasion that
I loved Persuasion the most, actually. I read Pride and Prejudice first, and then I think I read Emma. And it was when I came to Persuasion that I was like, actually, this is my favourite of hers, yeah. But I did love her Juvenalia. The one that Love and Friendship is based on. You know the film with Kate Beckinsale?
Oh.
The horrid woman who's a horrible mother and just kind of social climber.
Yes.
So, I love that as well.
Because that's quite a sort of brilliantly... It's got all that sort of teenage exuberance.
Yeah.
But also, it's a tale as old as time. It is like, my parents don't understand me.
Yeah, no, and yeah, I loved it. She was my first literary love, old Austen.
But was any of that inspired by the big Pride and Prejudice adaptation, or did you just...
Oh,
really?
Oh, no, hang on, which Pride and Prejudice are you talking about?
The Colin Firth one.
Oh, loved that, obviously. I thought you meant Bride and Prejudice, which is the Bollywood version of Pride and Prejudice, which was really shit. And I didn't like the Keira Knightley one either. But I love the Colin Firth one.
I think it's so weird and difficult, isn't it? It's such an intimate thing, our relationships with books and the way we see them. Mm. And there are so many ways that someone could get it wrong.
Yeah, and the way they kind of speak to you at certain times. I remember reading Jane Eyre when I was 18. And I didn't understand what the fuss was. I was like, this is crap. I don't like it. One of the biggest pieces of literature, one of the most profoundest works. And I was like, this is crap. And then I read it again in my mid to late 20s. And I absolutely loved it. And now it's one of my favourites. So it's really weird how reading something at the wrong time can just give you a really bad impression. Like you and Barbara Pym, maybe.
Yes, I need to have another go at Barbara Pym. Let's talk about Barbara Pym.
The reason I think I loved her is because she's kind of Austenian and a mix of kind of Austen and Nancy Mitford, and I love Nancy Mitford, so...
I love Nancy Mitford.
Yeah.
A lot. How did you encounter... Have you got any?
So I've got this lovely little old Penguins classic hit, this one.
I'm going to talk people through it, because realising this is an hour-old experience. It's the proper orange penguin of Love in a Cold Climate. Deliciously sort of flicky spine. It's kind of gold with age. Can I see when it was what the publication date on that was?
Did
you write that date? 11th of December 2008.
Oh no, I did. Southbank. Yes, yeah, I did.
So that's when it came into your
life.
And this edition was published by Penguin in 1954.
Amazing.
So that's a proper
bargain. It was like a fiver, and I was like, please give it to me.
So were you already a big fan when you found this?
No, I don't think I was. I think that Love in a Cold Climate was the first one. Or was it The Pursuit of Love? I can't remember. And then after that, I kind of got slightly obsessed with her, so as you can see. So the newer
Love in a Cold Climate. Yeah. And I love that Don't Tell Alfred. Those covers are really, really fun.
Yeah, really fun.
I'm going to see if I can find out who the illustrator is. But I love this one because I love Northy and them living in the embassy. And I think it's quite... modern. It makes me think a little bit of when Agatha Christie does her sort of social details on the 60s, and I think that she is, because things like Siege of Love and Love in a Cold Climate are such beloved books and people know them so well, but this is, I think, her writing so brilliantly about another world and the tension between generations, and I think so much of that is so relevant. Are there any writers that you've not quite tried yet that you feel a bit ambivalent about? Or
Actually, I didn't try Muriel Spark for a long time. I started reading The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, and I didn't really take to it. And then a friend of mine, who's a huge Sparks fan, gave me a couple of her books, and I really got into her. She's so funny, and just astute. And I just finished reading Memento Mori.
I did as well.
Weird.
That was very, very spooky.
That is very weird.
I loved it.
And I loved it. It's basically like having a cup of hot chocolate. It's just comforting, but also so sharp. It's dark and it's so funny. And I'm really beginning to enjoy her. And I think the next one I want to read is Loitering with Intent.
Mm. Oh,
it's a great title.
Really love that. I cannot tell you what happens. I just remember thinking it was fantastic.
Yeah.
But are you good at remembering what happens in
really
books?
I am really awful at remembering, which is why when people speak to me about books I've read, I'm like, which is great for this podcast, by the way. I'm like, I just remember feeling a certain way when I read a book and just knowing whether I loved it or not. I can't, my memory is really awful, so I can't really remember much.
Do you reread much?
Not a lot, but I do read, like Bridget Jones, I reread more than a few times.
I love you on Sentimental Garbage talking about Bridget Jones.
I'm so obsessed with her.
And I was thinking about that as a film. I love the film. I really love the film.
Yeah.
But I also felt very frustrated because there's so much amazing stuff in the book about, her mother and, Julio and
especially their
madcap.
Yeah. I feel like the film really didn't do justice to the second book because I thought it was brilliant. And also, I kind of feel like the friendship dynamic, the films didn't really do those justice either.
Although was she more in the second book, that you could have done such a lot more with Rebecca and that really complex dynamic of having that person in your world who makes you feel quite difficult things.
Yeah, it was such a shame that she was so one-dimensional as a character, because you're right, I think we've all come across a Rebecca in our life. It's really hard to kind of unpick why she's awful.
Because it's that sort of specific awfulness where they do make you think, well, maybe I'm just mad. This must be me. This has to be me.
It's a really subtle form of gaslighting. Mm. Yeah. So, I could go off on a tangent about Bridget Jones and Helen Fielding.
Am I right that if Sophia Kern is not obliged? Is that your first novel?
Yes. Yeah.
And I know that, there's lots of single women talking about the issues of the day, and I don't want to say, just like Bridget, but am I right that you said in interviews that you were very much inspired by Helen Fielding?
Basically, I was a bit lazy as a debut author, I think, because I was like, I love Bridget Jones, love the diary format, I'm just going to write a Muslim Bridget Jones. And I think I did.
I don't think that's lazy at all. I think that's really courageous and cool.
You're very kind. I mean, I see how people can see it's courageous because I'm basically trying to be like Helen Fielding, and there's only one Helen Fielding. But I am, hugely inspired by Bridget Jones because I just felt there was another part of the whole dating thing, Muslim dating specifically, that hadn't ever been written about in a way that didn't have to do with arranged marriages and honour killings, etc.
I think that's really true, that I am ashamed to say I've not read many Muslim writers, really, apart from me writing about, I don't know if I can say, secular life.
Yeah, that's because there aren't many out there. I remember reading Brick Lane, might be controversial, but I really felt like it didn't do justice to a kind of Muslim character, because I was like, this is just the same old kind of narrative that's being perpetuated all the time. And it's not to say it's not true, but it was very frustrating, because when you see someone in a book or in a film that you identify with, either religiously or ethnicity wise, you really hope that they're actually going to be representative of your life and, you know, most of the lives that you know, and you're nearly always disappointed. So yeah, the book also, Sophia Khan, by default, kind of tried to subvert those tropes that we've been fed, I guess.
Have you heard from readers who found it kind of comforting or encouraging to get people seeing themselves in it?
Yeah, and it was really, really nice, because I feel like the feedback was a lot more positive than it could have been. Because people really could have said, you know, she's trying to rip off Helen Fielding and really doesn't succeed.
And just like you did, you could say Helen Fielding, who I'm the biggest fan of, is kind of ripping off Jane Austen.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah. So, but no, people were really, really positive about it. Muslim readers, non-Muslim readers. I got an email from a 60-year-old Canadian woman saying how much she loved the books.
Well, that's brilliant.
It was completely mad and lovely.
I mean, I guess there are two things at play, aren't there? That firstly, as you say, I think everybody wants to see themselves represented. Mm. And so much fiction, and not for, you know, issues of privilege and problems that are structural, you know, they're sort of overwhelmingly kind of white.
And when they're not white, and when they're brown... Mm. Which is a specific term, by the way, brown. They tend to deal with really kind of issue-laden subjects, and they tend to be really angry. And I didn't want to write an angry book, and I didn't want to write a book that was issue-laden in a way that I was being angry at whatever group of people. I just wanted to write a book that felt hopeful and... also, not to sound twee, but kind.
Yes, and that's what I loved the most about it. And I think that's why people love Sophia Khan and Bridget, because they've got that. And that's what makes them so multidimensional.
Yeah.
But I've got friends, gay friends who are journalists, who are like, there are a few publications where, whenever they want to write about a gay issue, they get in touch. I'm like, I can write about other things.
I mean, I don't know if I can write about other things, but yeah, I do get approached a lot to write about if there's something in the media about burqa bans or burkinis in France, you know, I will be approached about it. And I kind of, now I think I've learned to distance myself from that conversation, because I think there are enough people having that conversation, there are enough people who have an opinion on it. I don't think I'll be adding anything to the narrative.
Growing up as a reader, could you have done with some Sophia Khans of your own?
You know, it's really weird. I my dad bought me a lot of books when I was younger, but there's a period of time, which probably around 7 or 8 years, where I didn't read anything at all. Weirdly, I think between the ages of about maybe 13, 14 to about 18, 19,
really formative growing up times.
Yeah, so it's very, very odd. I can't explain it.
Was there any particular book that made you fall out of love with reading a bit? Was it studying things at school and feeling frustrated?
No, I was just a very lazy student, so I just was loath to do any kind of work. And it was, but I know that I loved the idea of writing, which is what made me gravitate towards doing a degree in English literature. And I loved English during my GCSEs and my A-levels, but I only ever read what I was told to read. I never read out much outside of that.
Have you got any of your university books?
I have, actually.
Around here.
Here, my big old...
Is that a Norton anthology?
I'm basically a loser. Yeah, I can't bring myself to throw it away.
Those things cost like 40 quid. You don't give them away.
I know.
Well, I think I sold mine back to the shop.
Probably quite rightly. But I don't know why I randomly picked this up the other day. I was trying to be cultured. So I ended up reading an essay by John Milton.
Oh, what was it about?
Women's rights.
Oh.
Really interesting how progressive he was. And I think also I like reading about writers who have a religious background. I'd made a resolution to read more widely, and I was like, oh, John Milton, he's been around for a bit, hasn't he?
So an essay is good.
I mean, because
if it's me, because you think, yeah, it's not so daunting. If it was the whole anthology.
No, definitely not. Maybe that's why I loved Austin so much, because there's, even though religion is never openly kind of discussed or unpicked, it's there in the background.
As a cultural force,
exactly.
I guess.
So, and that's something I can really relate to. And that's, you know, I remember reading Graham Greene's The End of the Affair, and that part in the book where she prays that he hasn't died because it's been an accident or something. And she says, you know, if he's still alive, I will embrace Catholicism and I will never see him ever again. It was just such a spine-tingling moment. I don't know whether, as a Muslim, I could really... I don't know whether it was because of my whole faith thing that I could also relate to that. And I found... Yeah, so I found Graham Greene incredibly mesmerising, especially The Burnt Out Case, which I think is one of my favourites. And he's also amazing at dialogue. So lessons to be learned from him.
Definitely. I was brought up Catholic, quite strictly so. Yeah. And I loved Graham Greene because he seemed to be the only person, or the only writer who sort of talked very openly about Catholicism and how bloody hard it is and how it can make people really unhappy.
Exactly.
And again, that it's a cultural aspect of your life, is, you know, whether or not you're practicing, and it never leaves you.
Yeah, absolutely. And that struggle that he has. Another author that actually I've only recently come across is Anita Bruckner.
Oh, I love Anita Bruckner.
I just read Hotel du Lac. And I read it in a day.
Wow. I'm going to have a look. So it's above the bed. So this is a lovely, quite a modern looking edition of Hotel du Lac with the most evocative cover. Because I've got some lovely old Bruckners, The Gift from Producer Dale. But some of the covers are quite striking. And some of them are just like, oh, God, you see why she got that, the spinster rep. But this is just the mist and water and a sexy car and a bit of tree. And it just is a real picture of yearning.
And this book, I sped through it in a day. It just spoke to my soul. It was wonderful.
How did you come across it?
A friend recommendation. So I love a good recommendation by people who I trust in terms of literary judgment.
Do you have a particular friend or group of friends?
Oh, so my my friend Isla Ahmed, who's actually an editor at Virago, she's always coming out with some great suggestions. So I tend to follow her advice quite a lot, and another group of writer friends who are known as the Brown Writer Group, because we're all brown, which we're all very proud of. We're all writers and brown. How often does that happen?
Are these people that you know from writing, or were you friends who started writing together?
We basically just set up a little Twitter group because it was just so uncommon to have someone who's of an Asian background and be a writer. And we just ended up being really great friends. And now we just support each other's work, help each other out. And not a day goes past where there's not some kind of banter on WhatsApp. So it's wonderful.
When you're a freelancer, WhatsApp just becomes your office.
God, when you're a freelancer, WhatsApp is basically just the thing that you go to in order not to do any work. It's the worst.
I really notice now, as a white woman, you know, when I do events and things, I hope people are really aware of who they've got on their panel, and I think efforts are being made to make things more representative and inclusive. But what you were saying about having your writers group, and you know, it being unusual that you call yourself the brown writers group. No. Would you ever all
do you feel uncomfortable saying that? That's okay.
I do. Okay. I really, really do. No, and it's a horrible kind of thing to be. You know, would you ever kind of all be on the same panel, or is there?
We have done something
other than being brown writers.
Yeah, exactly. We like doing panels together, but I mean, they're all crime writers. I'm the only woman in the group, and I'm the only one who doesn't actually write crime, although one has moved over to more kind of thriller type, erotica type writing, which is amazing for I think an Asian male writer.
Can we give them a shout out? What are they called?
Yeah, Alex Khan.
And Alex Khan, I want to read your books. They sound sexy.
He just wrote Bollywood Wives, and it's been published by Hira, which is the new digital imprint. And so we like being on panels together. I don't think I've done any panels with them, actually, just because I'm a bit removed in terms of the genre. But we also like having a bit of a mix. We hate the idea of being clubbed together as just brown writers, and having to do events that just focus on our ethnicity rather than the work, and kind of talking about diversity. I think it's great that we're having that conversation. I think it's great that people are talking about it and actually actively doing. I can really sense that people are actively trying to make things more representative, more inclusive. But do I really want to sit down and talk about that? Not really. No.
Well, I suppose crime's very different, and if they're kind of within a genre, but you'd have, hopefully not now, but I'm sure there are still crime events where it's just a load of white dudes and nobody thinks that's unusual.
Yeah, it's nice to go to an event and see a mixture of just people from different backgrounds, whether that be your ethnicity, whether that be your class, whatever it might be. It's just nice to have that kind of variety.
I mean, that's interesting as well, because we've talked about Jane Austen, we've talked about Nancy Mitford and Anita Bruckner. We've talked about lots of other writers as well, but I was thinking that all of these writers are writing about people who are either, you know, aristocratic or sort of the end of the middle class is definitely, you know, comfortable. There's lots of, well, and I suppose perhaps a lot of it is the time of it and the setting, and you couldn't really write stories about those social intrigues because
though, could you not? I think class is still such a huge issue. I think we're just very reticent about talking about it.
No, I mean, I suppose it's more other classes aren't represented so much in literature, maybe. And when they are, it's because it's like, let's talk about the grinding poverty and not
the social intrigues. Yeah, which is the same when you're from a different racial background. So it's instead of making the race or the class something incidental to the book, it is the focus of the book. And I think once we've moved away from that, then we'll have made real progress. And that would be nice to see.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
We'll be back to Aisha soon, but now it's time for my steal of the week. A book so valuable that you wouldn't want to leave it on your seat on the train while you went to the toilet. This week, I'm getting ahead of myself because I've wanted to tell you about this book for so long and I just can't keep it under my reading hat any longer. It's not out until the 4th of July. It's The Travellers, the debut novel by Regina Porter, which is published by Vintage. It's about two generations of American families and how they coexist and intertwine throughout the 20th century and beyond. It's an exploration of how race, class, and gender collide in modern-day America. It's an extremely ambitious book, and it really, really delivers. It's my favourite sort of story, almost symphonic in its big, sweeping energy, and yet it's able to deliver great detail. I can't get over how Porter has created so many clear and vivid voices in such a full universe. I truly love this book. That's The Travellers by Regina Porter. It's available for pre-order now, and future you will thank you. Now, back to Aisha.
I want to ask you about the cookbooks, because it always gives me great pleasure to see cookbooks outside a kitchen. So we have Nardella Kitchen and Made in Sicily by Giorgio Locatelli.
This is purely ironic, because I can't cook for shit, and people have given me these books. I used to work at Vintage. So I took a copy of Nigella, because it's Nigella, and a friend of mine sent me Giorgio Locatelli, and I keep them there in the hopes that one day I'll open them and actually make use of them. That day has yet to come.
Do you like reading them anyway?
Or... I like kind of going through them and looking at the pictures.
But it's funny, isn't it, how Nigella is kind of like Beyoncé, where no matter where you are and who you are and where you stand culturally... You feel something when you hear her name.
Yeah, you do. And I remember when I worked at Vintage, I remember meeting her for the first time and just being completely mesmerised by her. She has a very striking kind of aura. I remember sitting next to her while she was signing her books and just constantly staring at her and pretending not to stare like a stalker because she's so beautiful.
So when did you work at Vintage?
So I was there between, I think, 2008... I did photocopying for like a year, and then I was a publicity assistant for 2 years. And I think I left in 2011.
Was that quite soon after you graduated?
A few years. So I did it was quite soon actually after I graduated, after I did my master's in creative writing, yeah.
And did that make you want to write more?
Oh, absolutely. I only got into publishing. I remember doing my MA and someone said, you know, even if you can get a job as a cleaner at a publisher's, do it, because that's one of the best ways to get noticed and to just have an inside track on things. And so I did the other thing, and I became a photocopier, and I just hung around for a year until they felt sorry for me and were like, you know what, we've got an assistant's job, do you want it? And I was like, yes, please give it to me.
Actually, that's slipping your own book in the pages.
Yeah, exactly.
Crossing out, I'm trying to think of a Vintage author, like by... I don't know, Martin Amis, yeah. By Aisha.
Ian McEwan, Ace, by all the wonderful ones.
What was the first book that you worked on?
Oh, I did, I didn't do many campaigns on my own, but I do remember working on Brian Chikwava's Harare North, and Fatima Bhutto's Songs of Blood and Sword, there on the right-hand side. You know, I helped out with Ian McEwan and A.S. Byatt, and it was really amazing.
So this is a really, really special book, because it's a record of your, like, God, Fatima Bhutto, I'm doing it again. I'm being really reductive.
You know what?
This stunning author picture. Fancy all the writers. I'm sorry. So what was the experience of working on this? Was it ever kind of intimidating? Was it exciting?
It was really exciting. And it was nice to work with an author who's also Pakistani, and I always felt like I was able to actually be a bit more helpful than usual with the publicity and with setting up events and stuff. So it was really great fun.
But it sounds like an experience like that must have been a real confidence boost in a new job to really connect with something.
I loved being a publicity assistant. Well, no, I mean, I hated it in that there was a lot of crap I had to do. But I loved being around, being in an atmosphere where everyone loved books, and just being able to work with so many amazing authors and getting to have like conversations with people like Louis de Bernier and Antonia Byatt. And just that's where you, as a writer, you kind of find inspiration, even when you're writing something that's a romantic comedy or whatever you're writing. Just being around those kind of professionals is inspiring.
I wonder if as well it just demystifies it enough. Just because I think that if you're someone who longs to write and longs to write books, and it can feel so remote and scary, and then you think, oh no, I've seen them eating toast. I've had to give them train tickets. I've seen them lose train tickets. It's fine. This is something that's for everyone.
And, you know, it also teaches you the type of author not to become once you're published.
Well, we don't have to name names. But
well, we're not going to name names, but, you know, there
I'm
are
here
stories.
For your stories, if you have any.
You know, just really kind of high-strung authors who are friends. Friend of mine once worked with an author who asked her to flush the toilet, her own toilet. I don't know why she didn't want to flush her own toilet, but there we have it. And I remember, you know, it's just not a glamorous job. I remember going to an author's launch party at an agent's house, and everyone was kind of milling around and networking, and we were all in the kitchen taking out the rubbish bin bag, the bin bags, and, you know, washing up. You know, there are some authors that you meet that who are just wonderful. And there are some authors who you meet who are just a nightmare. I remember one author who I worked with. It was Ramadan, so I'd been fasting. And I was speaking to him, I kind of made a joke of it. I was like, oh, you know, I'm fasting, but I promise I won't get anything wrong or mess up your flights or whatever. He's like, oh, you're Muslim. And I said, yes, I am. He's like, right, okay. And then he called the office and was put through to my boss. And he needed to speak to me. And he said, oh, I needed to speak to that Muslim girl. Completely forgotten my name, which is fine. I mean, it was funny. It was funny because you take it. I don't think people are hateful. I think people can be, you know, subconsciously kind of ignorant. But it doesn't come from a place of malice. So I kind of saw the comedy in it, but still.
Even so, it's startling. I'm so sorry that happened to you.
No, that's okay. My boss was also kind of outraged. She was like, this is just, this is everything that's wrong with publishing. And I also had a colleague who's also brown. And she started work at Chatto when there were actually no brown people in publishing. And she went to a party and an author came up to her and said, oh, you're quite exotic looking for here, aren't you?
Holy shit!
So, I mean...
Was that like supposed to be a line? Like a chatting up?
Who knows? But it all makes for entertaining stories, doesn't it?
I mean, you sort of, you hope it's shifting, but...
Yeah, no, I mean...
I don't know.
I don't know. Have I come up against something recently? I'm sure I must have, but I can't remember it, which is a shame.
I did want to ask you about is how that impacts upon the way you feel kind of as a writer and as an author. Because I think as a person who, you know, this has sort of been something that you always wanted to do, I think one does romanticise it a bit. And do you feel like having been in the middle of things, you feel like it sort of demystified your own identity as an author? Do you behave in a different way than you thought you would?
I think it really brought home in a very stark way how different I am from everyone around me in publishing. And not in an awful way, but I think that maybe if I had grown up in a very middle-class Asian household, my experience would be very different. But I grew up in a very working-class household. And so there was always that feeling of being very different and cultural references that I didn't always get. And I'd be angry about my parents not, like, you know, showing me more about middle-class white life, I guess. But it really, it kind of cemented this idea that, okay, of embracing that identity of being from a working-class background and being Muslim, being a practicing Muslim, because, you know, there weren't any Scarfies in Random House. I mean, there was one, but she worked in finance, so that doesn't count. I think it subconsciously kind of showed me that what I want to... whatever I write about, it will kind of pick at that idea around being maybe a Muslim And that faith and identity would play a prominent part in whatever I wrote about, because I think that sense of feeling separate actually lent itself to a more kind of authentic creativity.
And I think, yeah, that must be really important for you as an author, that it reinforces this idea that there's an urgency in your writing because it needs to be said, because you're in a unique position to say it.
Yeah, I mean, I love writing, you know, whatever that's about. I love storytelling. But and I don't want kind of identity and faith to be at the core of everything I write about, even though, having said that, my third book is literally all about belonging and faith and identity.
Which now that's called This Green and Pleasant Land, yes. Isn't it? Sometimes I forget the this. But I read it recently and I genuinely adored it because it's so evocative of that English identity is so weird. And there are so many ways of kind of, you know, and versions of it and permutations. And I guess I could really, you know, see and hear the, you know, the Austen and the Mitford and all of those social observations in there as well. Are there any books that you read while you wrote it or books that you had in your head?
Well, the Bible, obviously.
Ah, how could I not realise?
Obviously, because there's a priest in it. And I didn't read the whole Bible, but I did flick through it. I was also reading Watching the English by Kate Fox, which is a kind of observation of English identity all around England in the UK, which was really helpful and gave, you know, I'm sure inspired a lot of the ideas that I ended up using. I read because my agent told me I must. I never read anything other than Harry Potter by J.K. Rowling, only because I didn't want to be disappointed. And my agent said, you have to read The Casual Vacancy if you're writing this book. And I said, okay, fine, I'll do it. I read that book and I absolutely loved it. It was amazing. She's so wonderful at kind of painting nuanced characters and addressing social issues and in a way that's gets to the core of what humanity is. So I read that, and I also read Big Little Lies, which isn't a kind of obvious book, but my agent also suggested that I read that, and I absolutely loved it. And I read all these while I was in Dorset doing my research for the third book.
Whereabouts in Dorset were you?
West Dorset, so near Dorchester.
Right. I'm my mum and dad are from not a million miles from there, sort of Swanage way.
I stayed in a little village called Longbreedy, in this huge house. Basically a mansion.
Was that as a sort of a formal writer's retreat?
I guess so, yeah. I mean, my then boss, when I used to work at Cornerstone's literary consultancy, used to live in the west wing of this mansion. And she said, why don't you go there? The owners of the house, Harriet and Anthony, are absolutely lovely. And why don't you do that for a month? So I ended up taking her up on that suggestion. And I went, and it was incredible. It was a really great month, just speaking to people, speaking to local parish councillors, going to meetings, speaking to the local priest, and just asking people, you know, how would you feel if there was a mosque built in your village? And it was just really wonderful to see people react in such an English way. Oh, well, you know... I'd mind as long as there's not that call to prayer out loud. And you know, I don't mind Muslims at all. I just don't like the idea of like gated communities and the Muslims that don't integrate. And these are kind people. And this one particular lady I'm talking about, she brought me lamb chops. And, you know, was very happy to talk about her experience as a councillor, parish councillor and council member, rather.
What's your writing process like? Do you find a flow? Do you...
Oh, Daisy, there is no process. It's just trying to cobble together a lot of shit and hope that it doesn't sound shit in the end. It's once I have an idea, I'm usually very good at writing the first few thousand words, and then I kind of get a bit of a block. I tend to, once I'm focused on one book, and I haven't done this for my fourth book yet, but I do have a daily word target. So I'll say I need to write 1,000 to 1,500 words this day, Monday to Friday. And I try to make it like a professional job. It's just getting to that point, which is hard. And often takes more than a few months.
Plot what you're doing in advance. Do you know how it's going to end when you sit down?
Yeah, not necessarily how it will end, but I do have a very strong structure in place because when I wrote my first book, it was a nightmare to restructure when I was asked to revise it, and I just didn't want to go through that ever again.
Were you doing that while you were working? Are you getting up early in the morning and writing?
No, so I was very bad at that, working and trying to find time to write. So I left Random House and I ended up working part-time as an editor with a literary consultancy. And so that was great because my bosses would help me brainstorm and, you know, we'd work on ideas together and I'd be able to work because I was only working part-time. I was working 3 days a week. So I'd write on the other 2 days. And then once I got this idea for Sophia Khan, it just kind of, I managed to just kind of get it done. It took a few years though, on and off.
I think that's really, really comforting to hear. I think lots of people have that initial enthusiasm and they're really productive and then you do run out of steam because middles are hard.
Oh, middles are the worst. And you know, it's always a baggy middle, isn't it? There's never a tight middle. And that's not a euphemism for anything. Sounds like it should be.
It's a real Jimmy Carr laugh.
Yeah, middles are hard. Beginnings are always where you find the flow because you're really excited and passionate and you're like, yeah, this is going to be great. And then you're kind of 5,000 words in and you're like, oh, shit, this is really a load of bollocks.
What's the short story market like these days?
Well, short stories are I think there's a real art to them that I've not quite yet figured out.
Have you written any?
I've just recently written one for an anthology that's going to be coming out next year. But yeah, I've just written one short story, which I actually really, really enjoy doing. But it took a lot longer than I thought it would, just because, you know, they're so character focused. And you want to, you know, I did read a lot of short stories. I love Richard Yates's short stories. I love Revolutionary Road, but his short stories are incredible. So I read a lot of him while I was working on it, and also a bit of Raymond Carver, and what we talk about when we talk about
nice.
That. Grace Paley, who I bought this book.
Do you know Grace Paley?
Really? Yes,
it's
absolutely.
Also, it's Virago, which is a very encouraging sign.
Finally, I bought this when I did my master's, because my supervisor told me to read it. He said, she's amazing, you should read it, I really think you'd benefit from it. And I never did, because I never listened to any of my tutors. And then my friend, Isla, said, you should read Grace Paley's short stories, they're incredible. And oh my God, I've never read anything like it. They are absolutely incredible.
Brilliant.
I mean, just the characters that come to life within sentences, just the writing is so, it's not even beautiful. The writing is just constantly surprising. Like sentence by sentence, I could never imagine constructing a sentence in that way. It's just, she's really wonderful. It's very inspiring.
I always think of Richard Yates as being somewhere where there's so much sadness in the bones of those stories, and they're so beautiful, but they ache. And then a different kind of melancholy in Raymond Carver, but this looks like there might be some jokes in it.
No, it's, yeah, I mean, I've not read the whole thing, but it's wonderful.
Do you always finish books? Do you give up forever, or do you always plan to return to them?
I hate giving up on books. What did I read recently where I was so painful to finish? But I did it because it's meant to. Oh, God, what was it? I'll tell you, because I then started reading The Orphan Master's Son and I put that to one side. Richard Flanagan. Which people whose opinions on books I really admire and I usually love. And the writing was beautiful. You know, I think it was just timing. It's one of those books that I couldn't engage with at that time. I hate not being able to finish books, so I do try.
I think that's fair enough, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
That you can sort of say, I can respect this person's craft, but it's not for me.
Yeah.
When do you read?
Usually at night in bed. Best time, an hour before going to sleep.
Oh, wow. You're reading The Idiot by Dostoevsky, which is something I struggle to say. How are you finding it?
I'm loving it. So I read Crime and Punishment and a friend of mine said The Idiot is better than that. And I loved Crime and Punishment.
Aisha has the most beautiful... The first time, I think, in all of our books where I found someone with a proper bookmark. It's this gorgeous silver feather.
It was a gift from my writer friend. She writes children's books.
Oh, that's so nice. Yeah. I read a novel, I think I read it last year, or maybe the year before, by Elif Batman, also called The Idiot. And I'm not sure. I think there were meant to be maybe elements of the story. In that I don't think you call your own book The Idiot unless it's a little bit of an homage or a reference. But it sounds like there are some shared elements and themes, but that might be a coincidence.
Interesting. Was it a good book?
Really, really good. Really funny. Very kind of dry. It was. It reads like a Noah Baumbach film, and I love a Noah Baumbach film, so... But I should definitely read the original Idiot.
I'm really, really enjoying it. And I needed a book that I could just kind of... That felt like a page-turner after the slog of my last book.
Can you remember reading any books where you had a feeling that you possibly weren't supposed to be reading it, that if a teacher or parent found it, they might have words to say?
That's an interesting idea. I don't think so. Although...
Did you ever read any...
I sometimes read the English version of the Quran on the tube and feel slightly petrified, as well as spiritually enlightened. Yeah, so I guess that's something that I might cover up some now and again, especially if I'm on a plane. Weird answer to a question, but there we are.
It's an incredibly powerful book to own, and it's so interesting that the book... hasn't changed, but the world we live in has. Well, have you read it in its entirety?
I've read it in Arabic more than once, several times. It's just kind of a routine that we Muslims do. And the English version I read frequently, just so, because I can't understand Arabic. It's always nice to understand what you're meant to believe in. I mean, Arabic is a really soothing language, and I always feel quite kind of peaceful and comforted when I read it. But
is it ever spoken aloud? Do you listen to people reading it?
Yeah, absolutely. I tend to listen to surahs which are verses from the Quran via YouTube, just because I find it rhythmic and comforting.
I think there's so much more to language and words, isn't there, than what we think of as kind of the literal sense or, you know, this idea of meaning. It's so much less narrow than we think. And I think the sound of something can be so evocative.
Because I've taken a few classes just about learning about Islam and traditions and, you know, especially because of the kind of narrative negative portrayals we have now, you know, really trying to understand it and adapt it for a kind of modern living standard. And I did a course and they were really focusing on the kind of grammatical aspects of the Arabic language and how just an intonation, kind of like Chinese, I guess, gives a different meaning, not only to that word, but to the context. And it kind of it colours everything just via where a certain punctuation mark is placed. You know, if it's if it's a certain way, then it means something different or can mean something different. It's really very fascinating kind of analysis of the Arabic language, which gives different meaning, which is why an interpretation is kind of a bit of a cheat, because you can never fully understand what the Quran is telling you unless you read it in its pure Arabic form, which is kind of impossible for someone like me who can't understand Arabic.
Well, I think that leads us to some other books I wanted to ask you about. I see the Neapolitan novels.
I love those so much.
It sort of breaks my heart that I can't read them in Italian.
Oh, do you know what? I would love, love, love to read those in Italian, because if they are that gorgeous in English, I can't imagine what they're like in Italian.
Because that is so... I'm so curious about that process of translation to make them so beautiful and obvious. And because also so much of those books is about the difference in terms of the formality of language and the way people speak to each other. And that comes up so clearly in the English. And I'm assuming, I don't know, but I'm guessing that it's not... It's a much more... literary translation than a literal one.
I wonder. That's an interesting point. You know, just the pressure on the translator also to kind of honour what the initial text is and stay true to that. But also I wonder about, because the prose for Elena Ferrante is so... she does so much with her work, but to maintain that kind of, when you're translating, to maintain that kind of rhythm, when something's literary, to maintain a rhythm is actually, because some, you know, some sentences you read almost have a beat to them.
Yes.
And to be able to translate that must be really difficult. And I wonder whether people succeed or not.
There's something that in places, reading those in translation, it makes me think of Philip Glass or something that really... It's sort of syncopated. Syncopated, but rigid. And yeah, the beats, the way the beats fall is so deliberate and so sort of controlled. Do you have any romantic heroes that you are absolutely convinced by? Do you have any book crushes? And do you have anyone where you're like, I'm supposed to fancy them, but I do not?
I really do not. I love... Rochester, give me Rochester over Darcy any day of the week.
That's a worrying answer.
It is maybe. Should we maybe edit that out? No, I just, and I think maybe it's because I saw the BBC production with Ruth Wilson and what's his face, Toby. I can't remember. Stevens, is it? I can't remember the name. Yeah. I think his portrayal of Rochester is so wonderful that I kind of fell in love with that character, even though I'd read Jane Eyre before having watched it. I don't think I had the same feelings for him while reading. Or maybe I did. Darcy's kind of overrated, I feel.
Because I think that's perhaps my one... Something I really take issue with Lizzie. It's quite a teenagery thing to do, to see someone being a real asshole at a party, be like, oh, I bet he's really mysterious and sexy. Like, no, he's just rude.
He's just rude. Oh, you know, I think we're... Are we meant to despise him? Angel in Tess... D'Urbervilles. Hated him so much. I think when are we meant to hate him? I don't know.
This is possibly controversial. I don't know. I need to do Googling. When I've read Thomas Hardy under duress, being from Dorset, it was all like, oh, we're sending you to a Thomas Hardy theme park for the school trip. It's a hay bale. An actor who's going to pretend to whip himself. I'm always a bit pissed off by the way Hardy treats women and seems to have real contempt for them. And you know, you could absolutely say, no, it's because of the times. He was reflecting the times. But there's lots of punishing of the spirited ones and rewarding of the boring ones.
Although Far From the Madding Crowd, because that's one of my favourite books. And Bathsheba is just a fierce force to be reckoned with.
So I can't remember how things end for Bathsheba.
She gets with, what's his face, a really nice guy. He's completely devoted to her throughout the book. What we would call a player.
Really?
Oh, I loved Far From the Madding Crowd so much. This kind of devoted, faithful servant of hers, who she completely overlooks because she wants to be independent, and then she marries the wrong people. She's independent, she's fierce, she doesn't want to settle down until she's kind of made her mark on the world. She's incredible she's an incredible character for modern times, let alone those times. So I don't know. I know what you mean when it comes to Tess D'Urbervilles, and that's why I didn't really like that book, because I was like, what is this? Why is she so intent on punishing herself for something that wasn't her fault? But I think that's perhaps, Far From the Madding Crowd is perhaps the kind of the other side of that.
Well, I think you have fixed my Thomas Hardy prejudice.
There we are.
I'm going to read Far From the Madding Crowd.
That's wonderful.
And I'm going to...
Have you watched the film? David Nichols did the adaptation. And
I love him. David Nichols, if you're listening, he's a fan of the podcast.
Oh, he's wonderful.
And a dream future guest.
Oh,
so,
yeah, you know, he's...
This is great. I'm going to go and I'm going to embrace.
Because, you know, he was inspired. One day was inspired by Far From the Madding Crowd.
No.
Yes.
No.
Oh, you have to read it.
Shut up.
There we are, David.
You're not just saying that to make me read it.
No, absolutely not. So I don't want to give it away. So I don't want to give any spoilers. I'm assuming you've read it One Day.
Yes.
And everyone listening has read
I've
One Day.
Not read Far From the Madding Crowd, but I've read One Day
at
least 15 times.
So there's a bit in the book where Bathsheba is filling out all these kind of dates in her diary. And it occurs to her that, you know, there's the one date which we never know and we can never mark in our diary, which is the day you die. And apparently that inspired David Nichols to think about
one day.
huge thanks to Aisha. She's at Aisha_Malik on Twitter. Follow her, tell her how wonderful she is, and rush out and buy This Green and Pleasant Land. It's a Leslie Knope of a book, funny, smart, and cracking with energy. I'm Daisy Buchanan, and I have been your book inspector. Thanks so much for joining me, fellow readerphiles. You can find me on Twitter at NotRollerGirl and on Instagram at TheDaisyB. Say hello, suggest some guests, and watch out for shelfies. Visit our show page, acast.com/booked, for more information about our guest and a list of the books they've talked about. If you have any other queries about the podcast, email us at whybooked@gmail.com. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and it's hosted by Acast. Please do subscribe, rate and leave us a review. We always love hearing what you think and it helps other people to find the podcast. I'll see you next time. For now, I'll leave you with some words from Groucho Marx. Outside of a dog, a book is a man's best friend. Inside a dog, it's too dark to read.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.